Today, the fight to stop the spread of coronavirus. And 50 years on from the Biafran War in West Africa. What do you see when you look out of the window today in Wuhan?
I can see a traffic junction. It's normally a very busy, it's kind of like six lanes, but, you know, I now see three cars. The pavements are deserted. The shops are closed. The bridges are closed. The tunnels are closed under the river. There's no metro and there's no buses. It's a huge city. It's the size of, there's 11 million people. It's the size of London. It's like walking through the centre of London and there's no one there.
The city of Wuhan in central China has been on lockdown for a week in a bid to control the deadly coronavirus, which emerged there in December.
A pneumonia outbreak in China may have been caused by a new type of virus. More than 50 people have caught pneumonia in the city of Wuhan.
More than 130 people have died and thousands have been diagnosed with this new virus, which as yet has no cure. Every day, new cases are confirmed around the world.
Thailand has confirmed that a hospitalized traveler from China is infected.
It's become a global health problem. The World Health Organization announced today
the virus in China has tripled over the weekend, with the outbreak spreading to the capital, Beijing. More than 200 people are known to have been infected with the bug.
Many have praised the Chinese government for their transparent response, but there has been a flood of criticism on Chinese social media for the way the crisis has been handled. The mayor of Wuhan has offered to resign, admitting that the public were not given information quickly enough. From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, the global race to contain the coronavirus. Sarah Bosley, you're The Guardian's health editor and you've been reporting on the development of this coronavirus. When did we first know about it?
On the 31st December, China alerted the World Health Organization that it had a new virus around that was causing viral pneumonia. But I don't think we had the first death until about the 10th of January, by which time people would have been getting quite worried about it. This virus first emerged in the city of Wuhan. I've been there, actually, many years ago. It was referred to as one of the three furnaces of China.
Oh, why?
Great big hot industrial place. So what we know is that this virus first came from the seafood market, as it's called, in Wuhan, which actually sells live animals as well. Animals that have come straight out of forests and bushlands.
And what were people in Wuhan displaying symptoms of when this first began?
They had a fever, a dry throat or a sore throat, and then breathing difficulties. So the diagnosis was viral pneumonia.
The market where the virus began is in Hubei province in Wuhan. Kathleen lives there.
We first heard about it on the 31st of December. It was New Year's Eve and we were planning to go out and it was not really a kind of like a big thing about it. And it was kind of a bit jokey, really. We just went out and we stayed out late and we met many people and people were mingling and hugging and drinking, things like that. Just a normal New Year's Eve. As the weeks progressed, the authorities were saying, oh yes, it's under control, you know, we're managing, it's not a problem. And then last Sunday, they started to get more concerned about it. By Monday, it was about 5% of the people were wearing masks. And then on Tuesday, about 15%. And then on Wednesday, it was 95%. And on Thursday, it was shut down.
Sarah, how contagious do we think this is now?
In Wuhan itself, it seems to have been really quite contagious because the cases there have just been multiplying every day. But they think now that the reproductive rate is somewhere between 2.5 and 3. What that means is that every person who has the virus is going to infect up to 3 people. So you can see that one person infects 3 people, those 3 people then could infect 9 people, and so it can reproduce really fast. The team from Imperial College, who are modelling infectious disease spread for the World Health Organization, were talking of 100,000 cases in the world already.
Gosh, that's a huge, terrifying number, isn't it, that it can spread that quickly. Do we know when someone who contracts it when they become infectious?
We think that they become infectious somewhere between day 2 and day 10. Most people, we think, are going to have only mild symptoms. They may not know that they've got anything serious at all. The only cases that are being counted are those that have gone to hospital. So those are the serious cases. And they are far, far fewer than the estimated total number of cases.
Are certain people more at risk than others?
As with pneumonia, as with flu, the people who already are frail in some way are far more at risk than healthy people. So we're finding those people who are actually dying of this are older people, and they may have underlying conditions such as heart problems, high blood pressure, diabetes, people who are already vulnerable.
What exactly is a coronavirus?
Coronaviruses are a whole family of viruses, and we've met a few of those before. In fact, we have them around us all the time because most coughs and colds are coronaviruses, but those are very mild in their effects. So these new coronaviruses emerge from the animal population, and we've seen this happen with SARS, which is the severe acute respiratory syndrome, and also MERS, Middle East Respiratory Syndrome. Those were two very nasty diseases that actually come from coronaviruses.
Why are they called coronaviruses?
They're called coronaviruses because if you look at it through the microscope, it has a sort of edge around it that looks like the corona around the sun.
Is there any treatment for this Wuhan coronavirus?
Because this is a brand new virus, we don't have any treatment for it, and we don't have a vaccine either. So all they can do is to help people get through it.
Kathleen, in Wuhan, have the authorities there been telling people what they should do if they find they have symptoms?
No. Look, the way the Chinese health system is set up is that if you feel unwell, you don't have a GP, you don't go to a GP, you go straight to the outpatients. So that's why the hospitals have queues and queues of people. Now, some of the people will have the virus, perhaps, but probably quite a lot won't. But they're all in the same space.
Sarah, the health service in Wuhan is clearly under intense pressure. Do we know how medical staff there are coping?
I think it's pandemonium, actually, from the sounds of things.
Unconfirmed pictures from inside a hospital showing it overwhelmed. Patients treated in corridors, all medical staff in full protection suits. One doctor has already died. Another cries out, overwhelmed by the workload in a city that no one can leave or enter.
They've been flooded with people who have come because they have any sort of flu-like symptoms. And in many cases, that will be flu. It's not coronavirus at all. So all those people are there demanding tests. They don't have enough testing equipment because you simply can't for a brand new virus. So you've got the major Wuhan hospital in difficulties. And the Chinese are trying to build not just one, but two hospitals.
And there certainly has been a lot of interest here in the building of those hospitals. It is incredible that they can build a whole hospital in just a matter of days.
They did it in Ebola. It was quite remarkable. They could put a hospital up almost overnight. It's all prefabs and instant construction, so it's going to look more like an aircraft hangar probably than anything else. But it goes up really fast. It's usually the army who managed to do this.
In a frantic race to build a hospital in the next 10 days with 1,000 beds for those sickened by the virus.
What is the textbook response to a virus outbreak like this? And have the Chinese been following it?
The Chinese have actually done incredibly well, and all the scientists, all the experts in the UK certainly, have been congratulating them for being really transparent. They have been very careful to give us the numbers, give us all the data that they have as soon as they have it. Now that is very, very different from what happened with SARS in 2002, 2003. And that was really closed down by the Chinese. They didn't want anybody to know it was happening. And I think they were worried about the impact on their trade and on travel. And the first we really knew about it was when people started to get very ill in other countries. And I think they've learned the lessons from that very much with this one. So we have been hearing every day new figures and the death rates and what actually the Chinese think is happening. They sequenced the virus very quickly, which means actually analysing the DNA. So we have the DNA sequence, and that means that countries like the UK have been able to make their own test for this virus because they know exactly how it's composed.
That's so clever. And that SARS outbreak in 2002 in China killed nearly 800 people. How similar does this coronavirus outbreak appear to be?
Well, what's interesting with all these viruses is that you very often either get a lot of deaths, so it's very severe, you get severe illness and deaths, or you get widespread transmission. You don't often get them going hand in hand. What happened with SARS is that you got more severe disease, but less easy transmission. So it was actually closed down by the sort of measures that the Chinese are now implementing in Wuhan. They quarantined people, they traced all their contacts, and keeping people away from infecting other people, that's how you really get rid of a really nasty virus. So in both Ebola and in SARS, those viruses have been, if you like, chased back into the animal populations that they came from.
Here at home, it's not a matter of if, but when and where the coronavirus will first hit in Canada.
It's not a question of if the deadly coronavirus will make it to New Zealand, but rather when.
Have there been any deaths caused by this virus outside China yet?
No, all the deaths that we know about have been in China itself, and by far the vast majority in Wuhan. So we have had cases of people coming out of China into quite a lot of countries, including the obvious ones where Chinese people go, such as Hong Kong, Singapore, Taiwan, and also now into Europe as well. But and there's been a little bit of human-to-human transmission, but we haven't had any deaths, not yet.
Do you get the sense that this virus is in control at the moment, or not, because we just don't know what's going to happen?
I think it's the unknowns that are so scary with this virus. It's definitely not under control. We're finding the numbers escalating rapidly. What is positive about this, I think, is that although the numbers are shooting up, if you look at the death rate, actually, it's still about 2%. And that's of the severe cases, the cases that we know have gone to hospital. Actually, SARS was more like 11%, MERS is about a third die, and in Ebola you can be talking about a half or 60%, sometimes more than that. So actually, what we've got is wider transmission, milder disease in a lot of places, we think, and fewer deaths.
The decision to lock down Wuhan may help to stop even more people dying, but it has also meant that many foreigners are trapped in the city. This week, the US, Japan and Turkey evacuated people, and the British government is planning to do the same. Hello?
Hi. Sorry, Oriel. Sorry, the dog is attacking me.
Oh, God, the dog's stuck in as well. Oh.
Yeah. My name is Patrick, and I'm in Wuhan to meet a friend for Chinese New Year. I haven't been outside for the last 3 days. There's people going around in, like, you know, ski goggles, because we've been told that you could possibly get the infection through your eyes.
And what did you, a few days ago when you went out, did you have to wear protective clothing? What did you wear?
Yeah, so we've got the 3M N95 mask. We managed to get a box of masks from a pharmacy before they all got sold out.
So there are no masks you can get now?
No, we've not been able to find any. And the people who have been able to find them said they're only allowed to buy one box per person.
You are over there to visit friends and to celebrate Chinese New Year. When will you be leaving?
I don't know. This is a great question that I hope maybe a minister who could possibly be listening to this may answer for us. We've had no information whatsoever from the government.
None.
Well, we have had information. The first information that I received was make sure I wash my hands properly. The second information that I received was a couple of days ago advising us to leave Wuhan. The main issue with that is there is military and police guarding every exit from Wuhan. So I'm not sure how they would like us to attempt to leave.
What would you like to hear from the UK government?
Just information. Just helping me trying to find my medication in China would have been nice. Or, you know, telling us that they've been in contact with the Chinese and this is what is being said at the moment. It feels like, and this is every British person that I've spoken to, they're just frustrated with the lack of communication and information from the government.
Do you mind me asking, Patrick, what your medication is for? Is it for a serious lifelong condition that you need to take regular medication for?
Well, I was recently diagnosed with bipolar disorder.
Oh, okay.
If I was to just suddenly stop taking the medication, I don't think that would be very good for my health, to be honest.
No, of course not. And this is something that you've tried to make the UK embassy and the UK authorities aware of.
In my first email to the government, I stressed that I was running out of medication for bipolar disorder, and they ignored that. When I called to register my details with them, I asked what could be done, and they said, we can't advise you.
And if there is a potential that the UK would evacuate, Patrick, would you want to get on that flight if you can?
I think so, yeah, just for the need to get my medication, and obviously I have a job at home.
You've been covering this, Sarah, from London. What has the UK been saying about this? What have we heard from the government here?
The UK started by warning people to be very careful if they went to China and actually not to go to Wuhan unless they really needed to.
We have updated our travel guidance to British citizens to advise against all but essential travel to Wuhan City.
Hot on the heels of that, it was decided that we should implement a special area of Heathrow Airport where any people arriving on flights direct from Wuhan, which they used to do three times a week, would actually be met by health teams, including a doctor.
Well, tonight, new measures have been introduced at Heathrow Airport, where passengers arriving from Wuhan will be subject to targeted health checks.
And then that was soon not necessary because actually the Chinese stopped all flights from Wuhan anyway.
Now, the UK government is warning against all but essential travel to China. And on Wednesday, British Airways suspended all direct flights to the country. Anyone returning from Wuhan at this point will have to spend 14 days in quarantine. Sarah, what about people who have flown back from China since the 10th of January? Will they need to be quarantined?
Trouble is that they don't know who those people are. There were some 1,500 people who came into the country since the 10th of January, and they only know the locations of about 1,400 of those. So they're rather hoping that they might be listening to the news and will actually decide to self-isolate.
Sarah, as we speak on Wednesday evening, there have been no cases in the UK, but what about in the rest of Europe?
There have been a few cases in Europe. France has had a few, Germany as well. It seems that a German man was infected by a woman who'd come back from China in a business meeting, probably. Certainly they are work colleagues. We don't know the exact circumstances.
The World Health Organization hasn't called this a public emergency yet.
I'm not declaring a public health emergency of international concern today. Make no mistake, this is, though, an emergency in China.
Why is that?
They had two long sessions last week of the emergency committee where they were discussing this and trying to come to some sort of decision. And a lot of people did think that they would call it an international emergency, but they backed off at the last minute. And I think the reason is actually that there hasn't been massive spread outside of China. The vibe that's coming out is that they do think that China is coping. It's very, very serious there, but they don't need to alarm the rest of the world more than it's alarmed already.
And would calling it a public emergency, what would that change?
The reason for classifying an outbreak as a public health emergency of international concern, which is the technical phrase, is that you get a lot more resources and help from the outside into a country that's really struggling. China doesn't show any signs of wanting that sort of help. They've got the resources, so they don't want, I think, to have the sort of impact it might have on their trade and on tourism. And I think the Chinese probably have been lobbying hard not to have it classified as an international emergency for fear that it could get even worse for them.
How worried do you think we should be about this, Sarah?
Well, the UK is still saying that the risk to the public is low. It's not very low, which was the original classification. It's low. I don't think we need to be terribly worried about it, to be quite honest. And the reason for that is that it behaves actually quite a lot like flu. And flu does actually badly affect people who are frail, fragile, elderly. And the rest of the people actually do get over it. You go and stay in bed for a bit and you're clear. But if you take into account all the mild cases of the Wuhan coronavirus syndrome that we're seeing, or rather that we're not seeing, then you probably have a rate that's much less than 2% fatalities. So on the whole, I don't think we should panic. But clearly, we have to be very cautious because we just don't know enough about this virus still.
Sarah, thank you very much.
It's a pleasure.
You can read more of Sarah's work on this story and The Guardian's coverage of the coronavirus outbreak at the website. We asked for a comment on Patrick's situation from the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. They told us that Britons in China should make decisions based on their own personal circumstances, but that officials are working urgently to finalise arrangements for an assisted departure from Hubei province and are in contact with people to ensure they register their interest. As of Wednesday evening, Patrick told us he still doesn't know if he'll be on the first flight out of Wuhan. Coming up, reflections on the Biafra conflict, Nigeria's civil war. Now, this month marks 50 years since the end of the Nigerian civil war, a conflict that pitted the Nigerian state against the Igbo people and their breakaway southeastern state of Biafra. The fighting killed 100,000 and starvation thousands more. Dr. Louisa Ebenike reflects on a war that casts a long shadow across Nigeria and the West.
When people think about war in the late 60s, Vietnam immediately comes to mind. But there was another war happening in West Africa, and that was the Nigeria-Biafra War. The divisions in Nigeria had their roots in British colonial divide and rule policies. And when Nigeria gained independence, there were inherent tensions in the politics of that space. And these tensions escalated in 1966 after a coup and counter-coup. Igbo people living in northern Nigeria were targeted and killed. They left the north and fled to their hometowns in the eastern region. And after a series of failed negotiations, those in Biafra stated they did not feel safe in Nigeria, and Biafra declared its independence. And in 1967, a war between Nigeria and Biafra began. The British, being the former colonisers, wanted to maintain what they'd created, in part because the borders of Biafra included the region of Nigeria that had the oil wealth. So Britain backed Nigeria in the war, provided arms for Nigeria. But what was interesting was increasingly as the media were presenting these images of children starving, the hopelessness, the refugees, the displaced people, the British public had great sympathy for the Biafrans, donating money for the Biafran cause and actually putting pressure on the British government. And famously, John Lennon hands back his MBE because of Britain's support of Biafra.
As a protest against violence and war, especially Britain's involvement in Biafra.
The British government was under pressure because the general public didn't agree with its stance. And so Britain in turn put pressure on Nigeria. It didn't want the war to continue to be drawn out. And that in turn meant, you know, they needed to win the war and quickly. Biafra had lost a lot of territory. There were blockades in place, so it was difficult for aid to get in. People couldn't maintain their farms. There was no way of feeding Biafrans within Biafra. People were starving. And then, of course, the military attacks were not just on Biafran soldiers. They deliberately targeted civilians. After almost 3 years, the war ended in January 1970.
The bloodbath of Biafra seems to be at an end.
What has come to define this war depends on where you are. In the West, It's the image of the Kwashiorkor child, the child with the distended belly. That's become the image of Biafra. And so this association people have with the starving children of Africa, that has its roots in Biafra. In terms of in Nigeria, in the territory that was Biafra, people remember it in terms of a fight for the right to exist, a fight for the right to define your own borders. I mean, this was also one of the first instances where kind of colonial borders were being challenged. And there was also hope. People were trying to reimagine their space. They were saying, if we can't exist in this space, let's create a new space. After the war, those who were in Biafra, their Nigerian bank accounts were emptied and they were given £20. So the focus was on how do we rebuild? And they did. But the flip side of that is that this trauma people felt got buried. There was never a space to reckon with that trauma. Nigeria hasn't reckoned with its history. Many parents, grandparents aren't telling their children about the war. There hasn't been a sort of fully formed, developed notion of a national identity. And there are still tensions along ethnic lines in Nigeria. And I think when it comes to Biafra, part of the reason why there hasn't been a public conversation is because I think those in power don't necessarily want that conversation. Many people who were part of that war don't want to reckon with that history.
That was Dr. Louisa Ebenike, lecturer in English and specialising in Nigerian literature at City University. Her new documentary, In the Shadow of Biafra, is out now. Thanks to her, Sarah Bosley, Patrick and Kathleen. Today's episode was produced by Chika Ayres, Nicola Kelly, Hannah Moore and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Ivor Manley and the executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.